Good morning. Yesterday evening, just after 5:30, the Irish Horse Racing Regulatory Board ruled to ban trainer Gordon Elliott from racing for 12 months, with the last 6 months suspended. All of this the result of a photograph which emerged last weekend showing the trainer sitting on the body of a dead racehorse. It was an action that sparked outrage and disgust among the public and made headlines both here in Ireland and abroad. Elliott apologised, describing what he had done as an indefensible moment of madness. But all week long, both Elliott and the horse racing industry itself was under the spotlight. Here's John with Joe on Monday's Liveline.
I saw the photograph and it's absolutely horrendous. The guy is sitting on a dead horse like a jockey. He's on his mobile phone and he's raising his two fingers in a peace sign and he's smiling. Yeah. It is an absolutely horrendous picture.
Now, have you heard his explanation? His apology?
I read it. It's shocking. Shocking apology.
In what way?
The guy says he's standing up, taking a phone call, and then when he answered the phone, he decided to sit down on the horse. It's just, it is absolutely horrendous that one of the major trainers in Ireland could actually do that to a dead animal.
Sheila, however, took a somewhat different view.
It was wrong. The image was wrong. But I'd just like to just say to John, Gordon Elliott has apologised. And I just think it's terrible that you're looking for Gordon Elliott to be removed from horse racing. This is his life. This is his job.
Okay.
He is very good at it. The man apologised. I don't know him. But my God, he made a mistake. And I know he will never, ever do that again. That horse is going to be taken to the knackery. Like, what do you think is going to happen? It is not right, the image. Let me state that. He made it.
Okay, can I just ask? You would never see other leading trainers who are training horses sitting on a dead animal.
I can say is that image.
And then making some excuse that he was taking a phone call and decided to sit down because he took a phone call.
But I'd say the poor man is in shock.
The whole country is in shock.
Have you made a mistake, John?
In the utmost respect for a leading trainer like Gordon Elliott, but after watching this photograph, I've got zero respect for him.
Horse racing commentator Tracy Piggott also phoned into Joe.
I'm completely gobsmacked. I'm very saddened, disappointed and so shocked by the image that we saw. And I think what really hit home for me yesterday was the amount of calls I got from Australia, from Hong Kong, from Santa Anita Racetrack in the United States, and several from England, you know, asking what on earth is happening in Irish racing. And I was so, so sad because, you know, we love our sport. It's a wonderful industry, as you know. It employs so, so many, many people. But to me, at the very heart of this is the horse. You know, Ireland is synonymous with the horse, a wonderful, courageous, biddable animal that we're privileged to work with every day. And for me, I wouldn't be in the position that I'm in life without horses being such a huge part of my life and, of course, my family's life, my father, my mother.
Yeah.
And racing and horses go back in our family generations right to the 1600s. And I feel that the lack of respect that image shows, immaterial of how it happened, how it got there, who put it out there. It, to me, the reason for my call is to just pay respect to the horse. They are incredible animals. They put up with so much, they give us so much, and I just feel that somebody has to put that point across above anything else.
And Joe asked this of the former jockey.
And Tracy, is it an aberration?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's just, I just can't get my head around it, to be honest, and I'm sure you can hear the emotion in my voice. You know, they're incredible animals, and I think that lack of respect, oh my God, I don't know. They give so much of themselves and it's just made me very angry.
However, Joe's question was one that would be asked again and again as the week progressed. On Tuesday, a separate video emerged of a jockey sitting on another dead racehorse. Claire spoke to racing journalist Johnny Ward and journalist and breeder Kevin Blake. Both men condemned the photo and that video, but how horses were viewed by the industry came into sharp focus.
For me, it's absolutely despicable. If my pet were to die, I'd be absolutely distraught. The thought of me laughing about my pet in a photo having passed away, or the thought of me sitting on top of my pet, and to think that that animal died giving his all on the gallops
but
in training,
Johnny,
for a trainer.
These are not pets. They're money-making machines.
They're not pets, Claire, but that is the prison through, you know, most households in Ireland have a pet. That is the prison through they will see animals. These horses are incredibly well looked after. But to think that you could treat a horse with so little dignity having passed away, I think Gordon is in a really bad way. It's his 43rd birthday this morning. I think he's deeply regretful for what has happened. But the damage to racing is unquantifiable. Mm,
right. And we know he has apologised and he issued that second statement last night where he said, hands up, and he deeply regretted. Kevin, you wanted to come in there.
Yeah, well, you know, again, I'd agree with you, to be honest, Claire, in terms of, you know, the characterization of racehorses. You know, I wouldn't have them as pets, but also I wouldn't have them as money-making machines either. You know, the closest classification that I could come with is a work animal. You know, they're there to do a job, and while they're doing the job and, you know, in the build-up to it and everything else, they're looked after incredibly well because, at the end of the day, Claire, and it always frustrates me when people talk about the welfare of racehorses, etc. You know, there's a very pertinent reality here in that these are performance animals, and that it is in the complete interest of everyone involved that they perform to their best. And, you know, anything other than a horse in the peak of its health and the peak of its happiness will not perform to its best. It's in everyone's interest that these horses are looked after to the nth degree.
Meanwhile, the British Horse Racing Authority suspended Elliot from racing in Britain. His yard sponsor terminated its contract and key owners removed their horses from his care. On Tuesday's News at One, David Jennings, deputy editor of the Racing Post, spoke about his meeting the previous day with Elliot at Colentra House Stables.
To be down there, Brian, and in the middle of it, it was a real harrowing experience. It was to see, like, tears rolling down his eyes as he's talking to me. And the thing about it is, Brian, like, from his point of view, people are saying to him, and he's reading and he's hearing how he's cruel to these animals. And he knows deep down in the pit of his stomach that he cares for these horses so well. And now people are telling him that he doesn't. And hearing those things is very hard to hear from his point of view. And I think what makes it even harder, Brian, is that he can't excuse it. He has no way of excusing this, as he describes it, an indefensible moment of madness. He cannot excuse it. And from his point of view, his career now is obviously in a very, very serious situation.
And it was not only Elliot's own career that hung in the balance, but it was also that of his 80 staff. And some argued the reputation of horse racing itself. Here's Michael and Peter on Liveline.
My point is, so many people have been on hypocrisy to me about the love of the horse.
Yeah.
And my point is, how can you love a horse and beat the backside off it with a whip coming up the straight? That's my point. If you love a horse, you won't whip it.
Peter, do you know a bit about horse racing? I don't.
Why does a horse have to be whipped?
A little bit. Well, actually, that's been curtailed. I would generally agree with that chap. They have curtailed, and jockeys have been banned for excessive use of the whip or the crop.
That's true,
and that's as much as you can say.
And the rules have been tightened.
It's a never-ending argument.
Well, if you love a horse, you won't whip it. I would actually say that poor horse, if there is a God heaven, he's probably up there now saying, thank God I won't be hit with a whip again.
Well, I can't put myself into a horse's mind, but some of them do respond to urging by whipping. Four or five taps in the last few furlongs.
And
it is very much regulated.
On Wednesday, Claire got the view of legendary trainer Ted Walsh.
It was just one of those moments when people do things. We all make blunders and mistakes that we look back and say, my God, why did I do that? But you did it.
Yeah, a blunder and a mistake is one thing, but people look at that picture and they say, what else does it tell us? Isn't that the problem?
That is, yeah.
What do you draw from that picture?
Yeah, exactly. I can understand what people say. I'd say the same thing myself. We look the same way with different things that happen in other sectors of life. We say, what is going on that we know nothing about? But All I can reassure you is the majority of people that I know, not everybody, I can't talk for you, but the majority I know treat their horses with respect, alive and dead. And I, from my experience of it in Gordon's yard a couple of times and looking at the outfit, it's a first-class outfit. It's like a grade A, a five-star hotel. Everything is well looked after. His results show that his horses are always in top condition. His staff are well turned out. They love the old horses. You know the way they carry on with them. And I'm dumbfounded. It's alien to what I expected. I never thought I would see that on a, live in a picture. The garden would be sitting on a dead horse.
So the man that you know is not the man that we see in the picture?
No.
Be that as it may, people and their horses were leaving Elliot's yard in droves.
Best horses, a horse that most of us would dream about, Envoy Allen, has left the yard yesterday to go down to Henry de Bromhead, and five or six more went to Willie Mullins and somewhere else. And I mean, it must be heartbreaking for all them up there to see this great industry, the success he had, phenomenal success with his horses in England, Ireland, America and in France, and all gone out the door. It's a huge blow to see your whole life. It's like a deck of cards crumbling down in front of you. And I mean, his yard is gone, his staffer will be redundant, the whole thing that he looked at is gone, and the only person he can blame is himself. And that's the, it's not, it wasn't an accident. It was a stupid, senseless thing to do, and he will pay for it dearly for a long, long time.
Ted Walsh with Clare. One person not leaving the yard is businessman Philip Reynolds. He owns 8 horses that are trained by Elliot, and he too was shocked by the photograph. But after a long phone call and what he believed to be a heartfelt apology, Reynolds decided to offer his public support to Gordon Elliot. He spoke to Clare on Thursday.
And you're convinced this was an isolated incident?
Well, what can I do, Clare? I pay Gordon Elliot to train horses for me. Insofar as he does, I'm extremely pleased with the way he does it and the attention and care that he gives my horses. And when he rings, as he did last Sunday morning, me as one of his owners, I don't know how many owners he has. I don't know how many telephone calls he had to make. But, you know, he and I had a lengthy discussion about it because I wanted to be reassured that this was a one-off incident. And Gordon has told me that. I'm prepared to take Gordon at his word. And I'm hoping that others will do the same and we can draw a line under this and that we can move on.
And from his point of view, this whole controversy spoke to a wider issue.
I have listened to the damage that this is doing over the last 3 or 4 days and I just felt enough was enough. And this is not a story about Gordon Elliott as far as I'm concerned. It's a story about how we as a people approach things like this and what has happened to us and our sense of forgiveness, our compassion, our empathy. It's not Gordon Elliot. It's any other Gordon Elliot that would have made one very stupid, crazy mistake in his own words.
Yeah, but I suppose people are, Philip, entitled to ask why a horse trainer, certainly at the level that he operates, saw fit to sit on a dead horse and put a victory sign in the air. I mean, we have to ask questions of that.
Sure, I've asked, that's what I'm saying, I've asked those questions myself. And you know, and if because I'm not waving an animal first flag and shouting at the top of my voice, I'm seen to be any less critical or any less upset about all of this than anybody else is, well, that's wrong. You know, I've listened to all of that. I've gone through the detail of all of that with Gordon. And, you know, as I said, I'm saying to you, I'm shocked, I'm hurt, I'm disappointed. And I've read people's anger and I've read people's disappointment about this. And I respect their opinions about that and I accept their opinions about that. But what I can't understand, what I can't accept is that when Gordon Elliot uses those same words of shock and horror and disappointment and anger and sadness about what has happened, that we can't bring it in ourselves to accept those words from him as well.
Horse owner Philip Reynolds with Clare on Thursday. Back in a bit. Welcome back. The Disconnect, A Personal Journey Through the Internet, is a book of essays from Rosine Kybird, who spoke to Ryan on Wednesday. And she took us back to a key year for technology, and also, as it happened, the year of her birth.
1989. Does it make that make you a digital native or not? Am I right in saying that?
Oh,
or?
Very much so. Yeah. I start my book with a history of the world since 1989, beginning with March 1989, when Tim Berners-Lee first created the outline of the WWW layer of the internet. So we could say I'm exactly as old as the World Wide Web.
And she's even old enough to remember a time when the internet was a playful place, even creative.
I'm old enough to have caught the last of the benign internet, and young enough to probably have experienced it also at its worst.
Take us back, Roisin, to the benign internet times, because there's no people listening going, what is this Oz you speak of?
I think one where it was more segmented according to interest. So it wasn't this big, endless scrolling timeline of just angry voices clashing with each other, you know?
Yeah.
It was people actually building their own websites, customizing them.
Yeah.
There was so much more creativity as well. I kind of have like a... almost like a moment of original sin for the internet being the invention of Facebook, because suddenly we had to use our real names and we had to make our entire personalities fit into this grid of just, you know, boring white and blue, and everything has to be very proper and bland. I think there's this idea that dates back to around the 90s of the personal brand. So the internet is going to, you know, they knew at that time, like, the internet is going to change work. It's going to change relationships. It's going to change everything about how we behave in everyday life.
Yes.
And you will only really be as good as your presence on the internet. So you have to market yourself like a brand.
So you're defined by your presence online.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that caught on originally with maybe first these kind of business ebook guys, and then later, you know, MySpace and these kind of mad creatives. But then the most normal version is Facebook, where it's that sort of one-size-fits-all. Here's your page, and now talk to each other, but don't say anything too exciting, you know?
And it turned out she had worked at the internet coalface in London doing social media for a cheese. Yes, a cheese. A cheddar cheese, to be precise.
My year as a cheese, yeah, it was a formative experience. So I spent my days talking mostly to teenage girls about cheddar cheese. And then at one point, Harry Styles said that it was his favorite food and that he missed it in an interview. He missed it in England. And so suddenly I had this influx of One Direction fans. And that became my sort of day-to-day life, just talking, trying to convince these girls to buy cheese. And they were trying to convince me to connect them to Harry Styles, even though I'm just a cheese. What can I do?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was an odd job. But yeah. I mean, that to me is, that epitomizes just the kind of mundane, surreal quality, you know, that the internet has. I want to point out the kind of everyday but utterly strange things that technology has done to everyday life.
But the always-on connectedness and never-ending scrolling took its toll.
I started in a point of complete alienation and kind of paranoia. And really, ultimately, when I look back, it's the kind of state that the internet wants you to be in. Always connected, always,
yes.
You know, your kind of brain chemicals flaring, ready to react, and ultimately very detached from the rest of humanity. So I was barely sleeping. I have like a history of eating disorders as well. And I kind of got in this idea that I had the perfect routine, which is so deceptive, that, you know, I was successful because I was working all the time and then running on a treadmill at 4 in the morning, like in the Docklands at night. And ultimately, I just had a breakdown. I had a complete breakdown. And I had to go into treatment. I got CBT after going on a waiting list for a long time, and that helped a lot. But the other thing was a kind of self-knowledge, you know, with a lot of professional help too, but also just on my own. I think one thing I didn't have when I started the book, and but that I have now, is a kind of self-knowledge when I'm scrolling, you know, the infinite scroll, it's never going to end. There will always be distraction there. But if it's hurting me, or if it's kind of uncomfortable, you know, it's like I'm just not actually any happier reading this, mainlining information, then I step away.
Like, what is it? Scrolling.
Never,
just head deep into the phone, just going, like a hamster's wheel of death.
Yeah, you'll never run out of internet.
Oh, ain't that the truth? That was Roisin Kybird with Vine on her book, The Disconnect. And staying in Worlds Virtual, Nobel Prize winning author Kazu Ishiguro spoke to Sean Rocks on Arena about his new novel, Clara and the Sun. And the Clara in question is an artificial intelligent entity, a machine created to be a friend to a teenage girl called Josie.
So Clara, because she is a creature that's been created, she's a machine that's been created to stop teenagers from becoming lonely. Certainly initially, she sees everything through the lens of loneliness. When she knows very little about the human world beyond outside of her store, she's looking out of the window, just studying the street outside, and wondering who's lonely and are people behaving like that because they're trying to avoid loneliness. Eventually, you know, Clara as a machine, vision, I mean, she starts to ask wider questions, not just about loneliness, but about love. You know, what do human beings mean when they say they love each other, when members of the family are caught in these emotions? And she ends up asking, you know, I suppose big questions like, is there something unique about each individual human being that makes them very, very special and not replaceable? So, you know, what is it about these human beings that that makes them believe that it makes sense to say they love one person, but they don't love the next person?
And he talked about the theme of service running through this book, as it had done in previous books, in particular The Remains of the Day and the character of the butler.
Stephen's the butler. He takes pride from doing his little job well. Mm. And he leaves the big decisions to the people upstairs. You know, his attitude is that I can't handle that. You know, yeah. The bigger world is for somebody else. I trust in that bigger world to use my contribution well. And many of my characters are like that. And Clara is probably the latest like that. And I have these characters, I suppose, because at some level they're metaphorical. You know, I what I'm saying is that most of us, you know, in other words, all of us, apart from the ones who run countries, perhaps, we don't really understand the larger context in which we are doing our work to the best of our ability sometimes, you know, with great diligence and sometimes with talent and determination. But we're really just offering this contribution up to somebody else to use. And at the time, we often don't have the perspective or the vision to see how we fit in. And so I kind of think this is a very universal situation, you know, that most of us find ourselves in. Yes, I like to draw these rather extreme, exaggerated situations of people who are caught in these kinds of contexts. Yes, I guess I'm saying we're all butlers. We're all artificial friends. You know.
And in terms of Irish literary heroes, Ishiguro counts Beckett, John Millington Synge, and one Conor McPherson.
You know, I like his mix of the supernatural and alcohol. you know, because in the past, yeah, I find that myself. I like that sort of strange meeting point between dreams and memory. You know, they're both kind of foggy things. They're both things that make reality very strange, and the emotions kind of well up to the surface, and they can mingle. And I find that's very interesting. It's like the facade of kind of everyday reality has kind of just been removed.
Kazu Ishiguro with Sean on Arena. Love was in the air for Ray Darcy when he spoke to Shane Clavin. Now, Shane had gone on the TV programme First Dates, where he had met Avril. Neither of them had been out on a date in a while. In Shane's case, quite a while. 14 years, in fact. So, how had it gone?
Like, I think it worked because we were both honest about who we were. Like, you know what I mean? We were both there for the right reason. Both of us were looking to meet someone, and you know, both of us, as we said, were prepared to be vulnerable to do that, and we were both kind of genuine people, like, and she's a nice and kind person, you know. And even when I saw her walking in, I really had a heart attack. When I saw her walking in the dress, she looked amazing, like, you know, when Matteo walked her up, like, you know.
As first dates go, that's pretty good. Now, Shane's own story was very impressive. He was a metal welder, and out at his Christmas party in 2006, he'd had a few drinks, fallen, and hit his head on a curb. And this left him with quite a serious acquired brain injury.
Physically, the main thing, the first thing that happened was I lost my sense of smell. That was the first thing that went. And that's obviously never come back. Like, it's been, I don't think it ever will come back, you know, and that kind of affects your sense of taste as well. And memory was an issue at first, and kind of I was just hyper and full of energy and overactive, kind of like a childlike state, you know, because of what happened. I just had no control over, you know, I was acting extremely immature and childish, and at the time I wasn't aware, you know, I wasn't fully aware of how I was acting. It took, I'd say, a good 2 years for me to understand then that, you know, to notice what I was doing, and then to try and change that, like, you know. When people look at you, because it's kind of a hidden disability, people, when they saw me, I was still the same as I always was. I looked the same, but I wasn't the same. It just affects who you are. Like, I was a completely different person.
And because of this, he almost had to start a whole new life.
Shane, I'm just wondering, were you relearning or learning how to be Shane Clavin again?
See, I had no real memory of who I was before. Right. Like, I had pictures and stuff, and you know, I kind of knew I had achieved a good bit before in different sports and stuff I was good at. But, like, I played hurling for the local clubs, and I was good at athletics. I won good few All-Irelands at the shot put and the discus in athletics, and I did some amateur boxing as well, and I won two, I think, All-Irelands at that as well. Like, you know, so you know, I was fairly good at different sports when I was younger. Like, you know, so it just kind of changed everything after the accident. Then you had to kind of relearn everything, and even if I remembered who I was, the person I was after the accident was different. Like, you know what I mean? It wasn't the same old me. I was different.
Yeah, I do.
You're different. Like, you're not intentionally, but it's just
no.
Just the root of the accident. Like.
But that relearning was a long process, and his mam was key to his recovery.
So you 2 years where you were wild. So and you'd no job, and you were living at home. So your mum had to mind you, although you were an adult.
She went through an awful lot trying to manage me or to keep me minded, like. And then the more I improved, then I kind of started to realise how much she sacrificed to try and help me, like. So that kind of gave me more of an incentive then to try and be self-sufficient and to, you know, go out working and driving and do everything. I had a real feeling that I had to just be able to mind myself.
Right.
Because I knew, like, I had kind of foresight, like, if, you know, I have to be able to stand on my own two feet, and I just didn't want to be a burden on her or the family anymore. So I got to do a CE scheme in Enfield.
Right.
And that was a kind of a stepping stone for me. Even doing that, the doctors didn't think I'd be able for it. Like, right. You know? But I just put my head down and did it, like, you know.
So he's working with his brother full time for the past few years, and he felt it was time to go looking for a date. But why, oh why, would you risk all by going on the telly?
Thing with a relationship is you can't practice or train for getting fit. You can go running the road, but you can't practice a relationship. Like, you know what I mean? It's nothing else I could learn or study or practice. And with this, you couldn't, you know, because you're dealing with someone else. Because I got fairly independent on my own, and you get used to being on your own. But then that kind of scared me as well, because I didn't want to be sitting on my own in 20 years' time, you know, wondering about what could have been. You know, I wanted to meet someone, like, and I suppose the reason why I did first dates is because at the time I wouldn't have had the confidence to go up and talk to a girl and ask her out. Like, at least with first dates, there was already a date. There was already someone there.
Somebody,
you know,
else did it for you, yeah. So,
yeah, well, that's the hard bit done. Yeah.
You can't fight that logic. But back to that first date with the lovely Avril.
And were you worried about revealing your story about your brain injury?
See, that's a hard one for me, because most people looking at me wouldn't know I had a brain injury. And I have a big belief in equality, you know, in being equal. And sometimes the problem is if someone knows that you have a disability, automatically you're treated differently. And sometimes it's, you know, people will do it out of politeness or accidentally, or, you know, you don't really know they're doing it, but it kind of would, it just, you'd know people are doing it, and all I ever wanted was to be equal, the same as everybody else. And the problem with revealing it, obviously, is then everyone knows, you know, you have your disability, but I am proud of who I am. You know, I am who I am, and I'm proud of who I am, and it's nothing, you know, it is what it is like. And I suppose on the date it was hard to say, because it's kind of a lot to tell someone, especially on a first date, you know what I mean? It's a big
reveal, yeah.
A fairly big revelation, like, you know. you know, she was able to see that who I was and that I was genuine, and I could definitely see that in her. Like, you know, she looked amazing and she was really kind. Like, so it kind of does define who I am now. Yes. But it's just, it gives me more drive and ambition to be a better version of myself. Like, my accident was very severe, and like, obviously I could have died on that day, and now I have more of a drive in me that if something were to happen, at least if something did happen, at least I could say I did my best.
Shane Clavin with Ray. And by the way, him and Avril, still going strong. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Spring, a nighttime vigil, was the Mooney Goes Wild special on Monday, and it was an absolute treat. Contributors were dotted around the country and abroad as they observed the earth and its creatures opening to the warmth of the sun and new life. Ewan McElraith was in his garden about 40 miles north of Aberdeen in Scotland.
It is a beautiful night. There is a massive full moon out there, the snow moon, a carpet of stars, and it is so quiet. You can hear stuff from miles away. It's just, we've actually put a bonfire on tonight because it's a beautiful sunset, poured a dram, and as the sun went down, just listened to the dusk chorus. It was magical, because obviously we're a fair bit further north than you guys, dark now, but as the dusk disappears, you enter a magical world of twilight and then darkness. And that's when sound takes over, you know, the magic of radio. Nighttime was made for radio. There is so much happening out here at the moment. Spring's kicking off. The birds are kicking off. 2 weeks ago, I kid you not, I had 3 and 4 feet of snowdrifts on either side of my house, completely blocked in. Then about 4 days later, the sun came out. The wind came up from the south. And I was going outside my house about 5, 6 o'clock at night, and suddenly heard a robin sing. You know, it had moved from winter territory to establishing a breeding territory. And it was standing up and they're giving it such big licks. And the next night, there was a chaffinch saying, oh, hang on, I got a little bit of this. And on the third day, suddenly a sound I hadn't heard for months, the song thrush, suddenly kicked in. And I thought, wow. And I found myself just staring at the sun, drinking in the bird song. I was like, at last, fantastic.
Oh, you can hear his excitement. And as the earth awakens and creatures shrug off the shiver of winter, the birds get ready to fly the nest.
During the cold weather, the field fare, you know, the big European thrush, was outside my kitchen window every morning saying, where's my apple? Where's my apple? Where's my apple? And, you know, they're wonderful. And then suddenly the snow goes and they've gone. They don't need me anymore. They're grasping their chance and say, actually, I'm going back to Scandinavia because I don't need to be here anymore. But the thing that really got me, I mean, childishly excited, guys, hopping up and down, phoning people around. There was 25 long-tailed tits arrived. Ah. About 5, 6 weeks ago. I know you've got them, loads of them in Ireland, but I was so excited about them. And that's part of the joy of at this time of night, because you know that they're out there, probably huddled up. There might be 30 of them huddled up in the nuke of a tree for bodily warmth. You know, the size of a goldcrest, Britain's smallest bird with this massive long tail. And the nest is just fantastic. They used to collect them to decorate Victorian salons, the boudoirs, because they were so pretty. And they take the silk from spiders' webs and they get feathers from a plucking station at the bottom of a bird of prey, which is a risky thing to do. And they weave this nest and they hang little bits of lichen on it. 3,000 individual actions to make this tiny, stretchy nest that's like a big goose egg with a little hole in the top that stretches so the birds can get out there. And they're doing that at the moment because it takes so long to make it. And it's just mind-blowing that out there, there are so many things happening that we're not aware of. You know, I can hear, you get the sounds of the wood pigeon cooing, say, yeah, I'm all right, or the pheasant gets disturbed by the badger, or you get that scream of the vixen, you know, that blood-curdling scream, or the road, you're going, ugh, ugh. There's so much at night, you know, there's lots going on in the spring and the day, but at night time there's a lot going on as well.
From the spring special on Mooney Goes Wild, well worth a listen. And The Small Hours and Mystery of Night featured a new writing from the drama on One on Sunday. Small Bones by Siobhan Mannion was performed by Cathy Rose O'Brien.
Night is falling. There is work I could be doing. Outside of the classes, today was the first time in a long time that I switched on the piano. And bang, that fuse blew. There is work I should be doing, instead of just sitting here. The clocks go back tonight. Time folding over itself. Time, our human attempt to impose order on the universe. To harmonize the 7.8 billion of us. Including the three living up there, in the sky, in space. Where night means tethering their bodies to their bunks, arms floating in open gestures unless deliberately pinned down. The simplest details of living made strange.
Oh, so beautiful. That was Small Bones by Siobhan Mannion, the drama on One. And maybe a nice rest for the ear before we get into this.
Still singing Come On Eileen in 2021.
A street party in Castletroy near the University of Limerick on Tuesday night. And yes, as Audrey says, who knew that song would still endure? So is everyone really out partying like it's, well, 1982? Thankfully, no. On Tuesday's Morning Ireland, Rachel spoke to Professor Pete Lunn, founder of the ESRI's Behavioural Research Unit, and while he acknowledged there was a minority who were breaking restrictions, most of us were pretty good.
There's still a minority who are breaking the restrictions and are breaking the public health guidance, but all of our research would suggest that the overwhelming majority are still sticking with it and are doing it because they consciously are aware that this is something they've got to do to prevent the spread of the disease. So there's a real sense that if we're all going to do that, we can get these numbers further down.
How much out-and-out opposition is there to the continuation of restrictions?
Very, very little. I mean, depending exactly how you ask the question or how you phrase it, it's probably somewhere between 5 and 10% of people who sort of are taking what you might call a political stance that says this is not the right way to do this. I do not support this. And even some of those people are not necessarily breaking the restrictions, although they are clearly more likely to.
So parties and protests notwithstanding, we're trying to keep the head down or, as Rachel put it, at least outdo the neighbours.
Is it fair to say that we all have a tendency to be, or many of us have a tendency to believe that other people are breaking the rules, but we're doing our best? The old Welsher, you know, we're hard pressed in this house to keep going, but the crowd down the street, oh, their behaviour's mad.
Yeah, actually, Rachel, it's really quite extreme. So sort of 97% of us think we're being more careful than average. Now, a moment's thought tells you that cannot possibly be true. OK, so, yeah, there is that. And part of it is just a sort of basic optimism. And if you ask people a lot of questions like that, you can get those kind of answers. So, for example, about 90% of the population think they're safer drivers than average. OK, so when we compare ourselves with other people, we tend to be too optimistic. But this goes across not just how many people are meeting up with, how careful people are being. We can find right across the spectrum there, if we ask people these questions, they think others are doing more than them. And the primary reason for this is probably because you can see it. The people who are staying at home and are not going out and meeting people and are being very careful and abiding by the restrictions, you don't see them because they're not out and about most of the time. They're at home and they only go out for essential purposes. So we tend to overestimate what other people are doing because it's more visible.
Professor Pete Lunn on Tuesday's Morning Ireland. Now, Peg Sayers. Not exactly a barrel of laughs, our Peg. Her life story was on the curriculum from 1962 to 1999. This is what Ryan Tuberty remembers.
She stole an apple pie under her armpit. She ended up being kind of slightly annoyed about Coach Jim, who skedaddled to America and didn't send the money back. Somebody fell out of a coffin.
Yeah.
And they're the three. That's all I can remember about Peg after 2.5 years of studying.
Tharis Jach Sinead Ní Uachtaráin, who in a new documentary for TG Cathair is on a one-woman mission to reclaim the book and the woman.
Born in 1873 in Dunquin, married into the island, the Great Blasted Island, and spent her life there. And I suppose many people came to the island to collect stories from her, lots of storytellers, people from Cnosach Vale Idis Éireann, the Folklore Commission of Ireland. And it came to pass that she told her life story to her son, Mike Filla. He wrote it down. It was then edited by Maureen Ikineda, and it became the book that so many people studied for the Leaving Cert. So it's kind of a little bit like Chinese Whispers, I think. And it became the book that was on the Leaving Cert for such a long period of time, 62 to 99. And I suppose during that period of time, it became the stuff of nightmares for many people, because Peg had a hard life. It was hard on the island. She lost, I think she had 11 children and 6 of them survived. She had a tough life. As many people did at the time. So I suppose people remember that element or that part of her life and the hardship and all that she suffered and endured. But that was her life and that was her story. And all she did was tell it to her son, as was required of her. So I think Peg gets a lot of stick that she doesn't deserve.
Oh, them there is fighting words. And Sinead would go further. In fact, she would say that Peg Sayers was something of a superstar. On the Blaskets, anyway.
Lots of people gathered in Peg's house to hear her tell stories. You can imagine back in the day, there was no television, there was no radio or whatever. So I suppose the entertainment that they had was the stories that they had collected. So Peg would often have people gathered in her home, young people as well, as Maureen Nihalik told me, and Dáithí Dhúmura as well, telling stories. And that was the entertainment of the time. And she was a wonderful storyteller. I had the opportunity to go up to UCD to Cnosach Vale Idis Éireann and to actually listen to some of the tapes of her reciting. And it's, oh man, she understood her brief. Yeah. She told the story. There was a rhythm to it. There was not an nor an am. It was like a performance.
Right.
And that's what I think of when I think of Peg. I think of a performer. Also, I think of Beyonce. You only have to say Beyonce and you know who someone's talking about. Somebody else mentioned this in the story, in the program as well. They said, all you have to say is Bono. All you have to say is Peg, and people know who you're talking about.
It's, you know, she's very sure. Fair point. She's the Cher of the Blaskets.
Cher of the Blaskets. How's that for revisionism? Well, that's it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.